Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.
Like, this is us, like, learning in public and, like, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We're at Vancouver Public Library.
Yes.
There are glass doors.
Yes.
We're literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala.
This is Scene.
Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
In our last episode, we were talking about the complicity of men who don't actually commit rape or abuse, who maybe think of themselves as good people, as feminists, the ways that they contribute to our experiences of violence and abandonment and harm in our communities. And something that came up was the fact that it's not just men. It's not just non-survivors. It's all of us. It's people who look like all kinds of things, who have all kinds of identities, who participate in these systems. And that's a harder question. And again, something that we often don't talk about because we're so busy talking about
the worst,
the ones
offenses
who are doing the most harm. Yeah. Or the ones who have the most power as well.
Right.
You know, and at this point, it makes sense to us when cishet white men embody toxic masculinity and perpetuate rape culture and uphold white supremacy, because these systems were created to keep them in power. But then how do we explain the complicity and the active participation of the rest of us in those systems? I think it would be a lot easier if, you know, the people who looked like us or shared our identities could be trusted. Or, you know, even if our own marginalized identities made us somehow incapable or immune from participating in these systems.
But unfortunately, they don't, because, like, I mean, patriarchy is all around us, even when we don't know that we're contributing to it or upholding it. Here we are, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. So today I wanted to talk more about that, about why it is that we participate in these things beyond, you know, the socialization, because the socialization is such a huge, huge, huge part of it. But I think especially, you know, getting back to who we are and the conversations that we like to have and who we're doing the podcast for, like, we focus on our BIPOC and especially our cutie BIPOC communities. And in those communities, you know, so often we've done so much work to unlearn our socialization.
Right.
And we have the politics and we know the things to say. And yet, there's so much harm still happening from within our communities. So why is that if we get it, if we're thinking about it, if we have these politics, if we have these values? So, spoiler alert again. Our BIPOC of the week this week is Kai Chang Tom, and she's a writer, a performer, a cultural worker, and speaker, and she's the author of an incredible book called I Hope We Choose Love, A Trans Girl's Notes from the End of the World. And there's so much, and I think we'll end up doing more episodes where we talk about this book, because there's so much in this book for us to talk about and learn from. But something from this book that I really wanted to focus on was she talks a lot about harm and abuse and violence within queer communities. And that in itself is something I really want to talk about. And I think a lot of what she says about queer communities, we can also kind of extrapolate into other communities of marginalized folks who think that
we get it, or that we're like,
we get it.
Yeah.
And that our communities are going to be these like safe havens,
right?
You know, because often we come from this oppressive world and we think, okay, now I'm with my people. You know, we find these communities of cutie BIPOC, of BIPOC, but we think, okay, like, this is going to be different because these people get it and these people also want to fight oppression and these people are also, like, you know, invested in my well-being and my liberation. And then we get so harmed.
Right. And I think sometimes feels like betrayal when you have that level of expectation and trust that's inherently, like, almost built in, and you kind of assume that everybody shares the same ways of being. Like, I think I've mentioned this before in another episode, like when it comes to the church, for example, it's like you come into a space where you think, oh, we all share the same beliefs, but then you see how harmful people can be, even though they identify as, like, you know, a Christian, let's say. And you're like, yes. Yo, I thought we were all, like, all God's children, but apparently some of us are not. And so, yeah, I think it's that level of deep betrayal. That, and then it can end up making you feel like, yo, so then where is safe for me to exist? And how do I challenge sometimes structural? But a lot of the times I notice, and maybe you'll get into this today, it's a lot of, like, interpersonal ways of being with each other. Because, like, once we've gotten into those spaces where they're, like, let's say QT BIPOC, where we feel like we have the same politics, it might not be, like, the structural, like, big sort of, like, red flags that we usually would see beyond our communities, but it might be the ways that, like, interpersonal relationships are playing out and the ways in which we're using tactics that are, like, usually considered, like, outsider tactics within, in really covert ways. Like, how do we even know and to identify those things too?
Totally. Exactly. Yes. Yes. I definitely want to talk about all of that today. So I just wanted to start with a quote from the book. And in some of these quotes, she uses a term called Queerlandia, where she's talking about, like, sort of the safe haven that a lot of queers expect when they find queer community.
Right.
So she said, "Real life queer communities are full of wounded dreamers. How could they not be? And because we are so wounded, we are not prepared for the reality of bad things happening among us. How to talk about it, how to hold it, how to heal from it. We do not know how to have difficult conversations, how to look at each other through the lenses of love and justice at the same time. You either belong in Queerlandia or you do not. There is no in between. Perhaps this is why we so rarely look at ourselves and our own culpability when bad things happen. Why we are so eager to brand those who do harm in our communities as monsters. For what is a monster, after all? A creature who comes from the in-between. In between fantasy and reality, good and evil, healing and hurtful. We make monsters from that which we fear to see in the mirror."
I like that rebranding and reframing of monster a lot. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of the times, in my mind, it's always framed as, like, an outsider or something that's completely unknown and foreign to us. But the way that she's describing it, it sounds like it could be something that is more known than we knew and closer to us than we knew. And then at the beginning of that quote, like, we don't know how to have these kinds of conversations. And that window of tolerance that you had talked about, like, for a long time ago, and we bring it up a lot. How do we create a window of tolerance, so to speak, within these spaces so that we can have these conversations without it seeming like, oh, you're derailing or you're making, you know, you're creating conflict? Because then when we're framed as creating conflict, when we're trying to unpack and hold people accountable, then we can be, like, booted out. You're either inside or you're outside of it. And like, how so many of us have to make concessions sometimes to, like, remain inside of the community, even though we're experiencing a lot of harm and abuse, and there's not much interest in really addressing the elephant in the room. Because sometimes we actually all know what we're seeing, but no one wants to say it because we're like, but this is Queerlandia. Like, it's good, right? You know, don't want to rock the boat.
That's one of the biggest ways that survivors are harmed, is that we have to face this choice of be quiet and go along or leave. And I mean, you know, I talked in the last episode and we've talked about ways that we've experienced that. But also, I think something that's really powerful in Kai Cheng Tom's book is that she also talks about ways that she's participated in it. You know, that there are times where she's seen harm and violence and exploitation and has tried to sort of stand in solidarity with the person harmed, but quietly. Again, like, kind of whispering to them, like, oh yeah, that was fucked up. Like, I'm, you know, how can I support you? But, like, within the greater community, not saying anything because of fear, because we're afraid that we will get kicked out. And this is all we have because, you know, within the bigger world, we already know we don't belong there. So when we actually find a community where we think we might belong,
you want to hold on to it and keep it as long as you can, kind of intact without disrupting. And that's so unfortunate that, like, these, I would call all of this, like, sites of potential conflict, like, where we're getting treated in places or treated in ways that are harmful to us, and there, that's a conflict. And it's like, conflict can also be, like, generative. There can be things that we learn through conflict that I don't know if we're able to really create opportunities to learn from it. And when sometimes, I've witnessed this in on social media and certain groups. I don't know if you're familiar with Jewel the Gem, but there had been, and I honestly don't know enough about the context, but just basically holding somebody who is part of, like, a survivor community of, like, queer Black folks accountable for sexual violence and what that looked like. And it was just interesting to see how it all unraveled. I mean, it was on Instagram and in, like, social media spheres, because that's where the community was built. But the accountability piece and, like, just talking through that, I was like, wow, I've never witnessed what it looks like to call somebody out in and then deplatform and talk through all the, you know, all of the reasons why this is important.
Totally. Yeah. It's skills that we don't have. And that's really frightening. It's like, what do we do if we don't know another way, you know, because there have been other ways in some of our Indigenous cultures, and they've been so stamped out by this system of violence that we now all live in. Not to make our Indigenous cultures, you know, not to flatten them or think that they were, like, a utopia, but the system that we live in now is very, on a very extreme end of individualism and power and violence. And so, you know, more community-based approaches to dealing with harm, I think, have been very lost.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, yeah.
And I also wanted to talk about entitlement and the entitlements that some of us feel, because I think entitlement is actually one of the biggest causes of abuse. So there's actually a book called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And it's by someone named Lendi Bancroft. But something that he talks about in that book is the causes of abuse. And he really is clear that anger is not the problem. It's not that, you know, abusers are uniquely angry, or that they have, you know, unusually low abilities to control their anger. That one of the biggest problems, maybe the biggest problem, is entitlement. And so he uses this analogy where he says, you know, imagine if there's this big green, beautiful space out in nature. And since you were born, you've been taken there and told, this belongs to you. This is yours. And, you know, as you get older, you can do whatever you want with it. And this is, like, this is solely for you, and you're going to get to build on it or use it or live on it however you want.
Okay.
And then after, you know, decades of this, you know, you're seeing people treading on it and, like, going on this land and, like, setting up there and, like, you know, camping there and having picnics there, and you've believed all your life that this belongs to you alone and no one else has the right to do that. That's going to make you really, really angry.
Right.
But the fact is that actually that land never belonged to you. That was always public land. And the problem in this is not your anger at the people who are on the land. The problem is actually your underlying belief that that land belongs to you.
Hmm.
So I think that's a really important distinction to think about. And then I think when we think about, okay, how does that look in practice? Again, we see it a lot with, you know, cishet white men. That's a really easy way to notice it, right? Like, men who think that they're entitled to women's bodies, that they're entitled to women's labor, that they're entitled to, you know, they women's see themselves silence. As a protagonist in every story. Right. And, you know, they should have power. They should have whatever else.
Right.
But often we see in marginalized groups, we've all been socialized into the same culture that puts power on this pedestal and wealth on this pedestal and like certain, you know, very individualist dreams on this pedestal. And a lot of us in marginalized groups are left thinking like, well, what, why shouldn't I get that too?
I want a piece of the pie. I want that too. It looks good.
And I think I especially notice it, you know, the closer the people who are like one or maybe two steps away from that white cishet man ideal, you know, I see it a lot in white women.
Yeah.
I see it a lot in gay white men.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see it a lot in cishet men of color, where they're so close to that ideal and they think I should be on that pedestal too, or right. I should be getting that too.
Yeah. 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 So you're saying like the piece about I should be able to get it too. We're talking specifically about power. We're talking about having some form of control or whatever is constructed as like the thing that typically is only reserved for cishet white men. That is it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of liberation movements end up getting derailed by people who don't really want us all to get free, but they just, they want the power that those cishet white men have.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, wanting that power and then your ego getting to the place where you believe that that is like ego and entitlement and feeling like nobody dare check me for wanting this thing. I'm so happy that you mentioned that anger is not the problem, because like it's not. It's more like why you are angry. Like, it's why you are angry, and I think it's how you express the anger. Like, but the actual anger in and of itself, I think, like, it is kind of what it is, if that makes sense.
Totally. Another example that he, like, a real-life example that he used in the book to explain that point was an abusive man. He's in a relationship with a woman, and she had a young son, and the young son went missing. And so she obviously was absolutely terrified and was like calling everybody that in the community, like making flyers, driving around looking for him, like everything that she could do. And then after 2 days of this, of the son being missing and her just frantically doing everything she could to try to find him, the abusive partner blew up at her because he was like, I'm so sick and tired of being ignored and like, how dare you treat me like this and all this kind of thing. Again, the problem is not that he didn't control his anger. The problem is that he was so entitled and so lacking in empathy for her that he saw it as a slight to him that she was focused on finding her 4-year-old son who went missing instead of catering to whatever his, you know, whims were in those 2 days.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That story disturbs me in many ways, but I hear, like, I see, yeah, it's less about... It's less about the actual emotion of anger and more about like not realizing that maybe it's not about you in this moment. Maybe you're not the one experiencing the most amount of harm. So it shouldn't really be about what you need anyways right now. Like,
exactly. And I think, again, to go back to talking about the ways all of us embody this, I think often, you know, people who have been harmed and traumatized our whole lives because of oppression and because of maybe interpersonal factors as well, then when they sometimes get into either maybe it's like the queer community and they think, oh, here's a place where I could actually like be loved and accepted and seen. And then they are looking for that in ways that become unhealthy, you know, or they're looking for power within that community because that will feed an ego or that will kind of make up for previous trauma. Or in interpersonal relationships, you know, it can just be somebody who, again, has been very harmed and is in need of a lot of healing, but instead of being able to work on that in a way that is healthy, maybe they, I don't know if it's, you know, maybe they don't have the resources, maybe they don't know what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically about like in spaces where there's always one person who is like the loudest, who's taking up the most amount of space because there's like this need that I need to be known or seen or loved or I acknowledged within my community that's already facing marginalization. And I think a lot of the times we chalk it up to like personality, like, oh, that's just that person. But it's like, no, but also like that person needs to be aware or hopefully like becomes aware of how them taking up all of this space in this conversation, even within our circle, even within our community, means that other people aren't able to be their full selves. Like it can't always be about, well, that's just that person living in their fullness. I think it has to be like, okay, and also there are other people who maybe aren't able to live in their fullness because this person is platformed or is afforded all of these opportunities or all of this privilege or all of this access or creates those things. And I'm not trying to say that if you are working to like elevate the needs of your community that you should like fall silent, but I'm just saying like in the ways in which like within our own relationships we might not be spending enough attention and care on other folks, and we say it's because of, oh, it's just like they're an introvert or they're an extrovert. It's like, no, but what is actually happening here? Like, how is this person being or exhibiting behavior that we wouldn't tolerate if they were anywhere else, but we tolerate it inside here because we're like, oh, it's just who they are. I'm like, is it who they are, or is it that there are other things at play? Like, I need you to meet my needs, and my needs are that I need to be like, everyone needs to respect me, everyone needs to love me, like those, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and then I think when you get people who take up that much space in communities, then there becomes also a power that they get. And when we have power, I mean, we live in a very violent culture. And so that power allows us to take and extract a lot of things, right? That's colonialism, right? Is like taking and extracting. And so you see a lot of people in communities with power, you know, suddenly feeling entitled to get a lot of sex, or they, you know, they think they are owed that, or they deserve it, or that of course everybody's going to want to give them that. Mm-hmm. And they end up committing sexual assault.
And I think about that in the context of like people who are platformed or have privilege within our own communities. And then who in the outside world sees that person as representative of that community. And then what happens is like everyone's afraid to tell that person no. Mm-hmm. Like, and it comes back to that piece that you just said about like the consent or like the like violence that you might be able to commit, but also just that you're able to like walk all over people because people are scared of you. You know, people are scared to say no to you, or people are scared to like call you out or check you because it's like, well, that might like unravel the entire fabric of like the community that has been built around this person.
Exactly.
If that makes sense.
We're afraid to lose that community. We're afraid to lose relationships. We're afraid to lose our status within the community. And I just, again, we live in a very violent culture. So something Kai Ching Tom says in the book, she says, in the world I had grown up in, love and rage were so closely linked as to be almost synonymous. And I know that I'm not the only one. Isn't that the message that parents give to queer children as they punish them? Now look what you made me do. This is for your own good. It hurts me more than it hurts you.
That feels the it hurts me more than it hurts you. You would never tell, like, I don't know. There's just, it's so fascinating when we're talking about this. It's like, there's so many behaviors and ways of being that we would never tolerate from other people. So it's like, why should we tolerate them in our queerlandias? You know, like, why would we? And that idea of like, it hurts you more than it hurts you to justify abuse or justify harm, or to like equate what I did to you as what you did to me. It's like the same kind of thing. Like, now we're even, like, you did this to me. So, you know what I mean? Like, that is not even living in reality. Mm-hmm. It's like fabricating truths.
Absolutely. But again, I think, you know, when we said earlier, we don't know how to have these conversations. We don't know how to deal with conflict and harm. And I mean, a few things, like I can't remember who said this, but it was somebody, I remember it was on the How to Survive the End of the World podcast. And they were talking, I think, about transformative justice. And I think it was a guest who had said, you know, no one enters violence for the first time by committing it.
Wow. Okay.
It's like we live in this world that's very violent. We experience violence. We start to learn that, you know, reacting in this like very punitive, violent way, that that is just how you handle things. Like, we don't have better ways to handle conflict. Mm-hmm. And especially when you get people who have been very harmed and they see themselves as the victim all the time. They see themselves as the underdog. They have this, and we don't have complex understandings of survivors who are perpetrators and perpetrators who are survivors. So when people have experienced all this harm, they see themselves as perpetually in the right, and everything that they do is just self-defense. And so much violence gets committed by people who, again, then the entitlement piece comes in, because it's like, you've hurt me in some way, and so now I feel entitled to respond however I want because I am the victim and this is just what I have to do to defend myself.
Damn. In my mind, that just creates like this continuous cycle of, like, you know, people say like circling the drain, like with a toilet flush. Like, I just imagine that, just like you keep on going in circles, like you're actually never able to interrupt or disrupt that, because it's like, if we're all in, let's say we're all in a community of survivors, are we always going to continue to justify harm because we've been harmed? Like, are we just going to keep on going back and forth, for example? Or if we're all in a community of folks who have been marginalized, who are not survivors, let's say, like, are we going to keep on using the same tactics that have harmed us to harm each other? Like, it just doesn't seem like the way to all be free, like you said. Like, some of us are actually not, some of us are invested in like circling the drain forever, to be honest, because we actually don't know what like not circling the drain looks like. It's unknown, and maybe we fear what that might be like to step outside of that known circling, that known kind of like orbiting of like hurt me, hurt you, hurt me, hurt you. And I mean, I think we're both here to say like there are more options than circling the drain, and like there are ways that we can use the things that we've experienced to identify how we don't want to continue to like perpetuate that. Like, for me anyways, as a survivor, it's like learning how I like use my body, or how I like live in my body. It can't be as a like tool of intimidation, because that's like, I was intimidated. Like, I need to know and be aware of that. Like, that's important to me, because I don't want to make people feel like uneasy. Knowing how I felt in that moment of my own like a violence, knowing how bodies can be used to intimidate, I'm trying to be cognizant of how I'm not going to intimidate. And it's like, how can we use the things that we know hurt us the most to like break that circling the drain?
Absolutely. And I think that there are, you know, a few things that we really need to work on. And one, and Kai Cheng Tom talks about this, is we need to learn to catch things earlier. We need to learn what are the red flags of abuse and what are unhealthy or toxic ways of interacting with each other sooner, so that we're not waiting until horrible violence has happened and then there doesn't really seem to be any choice but to, like, you know, kick someone out of the community, or, you know, have like really huge sort of punitive or violent reactions to it. So we need to be able to identify harm earlier and intervene. And that's a really key part. It's like, we can't just like be like, oh, I don't want to say anything, I'm scared. It's like, we need to like build a culture of intervening and build a culture of talking about things. And then we need to have these other ways of responding that focus more on, you know, what's the culture that created this harm, like what was happening in our community that allowed this harm to happen, and then how can we support everybody to make sure it doesn't happen again. But I'll also say, I'm often afraid to talk about this, to talk about moving away from like punitive measures and talk about keeping everyone in community and things like that, because so often, you know, there's the idea of like support survivors and support the perpetrators, like support people who are experiencing harm and the people who are committing harm, like make sure everybody can heal, and we, you know, don't want to participate in like the carceral culture and whatever else. But I'm afraid to talk about it because we're so quick to skip over the loving survivors part and like focus on the loving the perpetrators part, because that's what our culture already does.
Okay, is that why you mentioned at the beginning, like, yes, socialization, but as you're talking about this, I'm like, the camp that would say support both and don't, you know, don't forget about the perpetrator, I think would be like, but the perpetrator was socialized in a environment where that was okay, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to being like, yes, and a lot of us were all socialized in that same environment and we didn't do that damn thing. So
yeah, totally, totally. Yeah. And I just so often, again, and I've experienced this a lot, is like people, even if they'll acknowledge the harm, they just want to go straight to like, oh, but they must have been hurting too. You know, right. If they did that, then like they must have gone through something.
Right.
And, you know, we just need to support them. And like everybody, you know, it just, it becomes another way to skip over the harm that survivors are actually experiencing. And it becomes another way that we end up getting isolated, or like we're told that we, you know, need to have forgiveness, and we're told that we're participating in cancel culture if we don't want to share space with someone who sexually assaulted us, or, you know, things like that.
Right.
And so like, yes, we need to support perpetrators and we need to move away from like the punitive violent culture of, you know, the circling the drain, like you said, but loving survivors needs to be in the center, and we need to move out from there. So if we're behaving in a way where we're focusing on the support and rehabilitation of perpetrators and keeping them in community in a way that means survivors need to leave.
Right. That's the thing. Right.
And it can't just be we're all survivors. It's like, okay, no, but in this circumstance,
yes,
this is the person who harmed this person.
Yeah.
And you want to like focus on the perpetrator's past harm.
Yeah.
In a way that means that the person who they just harmed has to leave.
Right.
That's not okay. And it serves no one, because I would also say, you know, when you're loving perpetrators, forgiving perpetrators, like coddling isn't love. And enabling isn't love. And loving people without boundaries and accountability, that's just violence.
Yep. To yourself and to that person. And to the greater community. Yeah. For real. Whoa. One of the things that comes to mind is Tarana Burke in a podcast episode that I listened to with Brené Brown was talking about how we don't really spend enough time as a culture and society, but maybe specifically in our communities that we're talking to and about, understanding what survivorhood looks like. We have conversations about like we are survivors, but we don't know the ways in which survivors continue on, and some of us continue on to do harm and some of us continue on to not do harm. And like, we need to have more conversations about like, how are we coping? Cause like a lot of the times we talk about coping in survivors coping in the sense of like doing your best, given the violence you've experienced. But also I don't think we talk about coping in the sense of like, how are you sort of like trying to pacify the pain by like hurting other people? Like the coping is on both sides. And I think like, you're totally right. It's not enough to like love unconditionally without boundary. That's not accountability. That's actually just not helpful. And it doesn't come back to like the site of violence that's happening in the moment. It's too like, let's talk about the socialization of, let's talk. It's like so high level. I want us to get down to like the immediate between you and me. Like, are you experiencing more harm than I am? And I've done that harm, but we've both been harmed by society or by other people in the past. Okay, well, I need to take responsibility for this harm right here, right now. Mm-hmm. And then the other shit that I've done or the other shit that I've experienced that has been harmful to me that I was a victim to, that also matters, but not on the back of the pain that I just caused you. Like, that can't be. It's so, that just cannot be, we're going to remain unfree.
Exactly. Because that's the thing, is I think sometimes, you know, we're responding to our own experiences of powerlessness and the ways that our power has been taken by trying to grasp onto power in whatever way that we can. And we live in a very violent culture where power over is sort of the default.
Yep.
And so, you know, a lot of people do reach for that. We have to stop that. Again, like, we don't want to be, like you said, circling the drain. If we don't want to be circling the drain, then we need to be able to say, yes, I have compassion for the ways you've been harmed, but that does not make it in any way different when you use power over in this way that harms others. Like, that harm is not mitigated by the fact that you also experienced harm.
Yeah. How do you think, like, as a, like, okay, so let's say that I was the one that harmed you in this, like, hypothetical situation. How should our broader community around us, friends of ours, people who know us, people who might know that this harm that I just inflicted on you, that occurred, what are our expectations of the broader community? You know what I mean? Because, like, we're talking, we did mention about not just focusing on the perpetrator and all the things that have happened to them, but what does that look like? Like, how can we call people out and in? And, like, when is there a time to be like, I'm calling you fully out? It's not about calling in, because I think the calling in piece is important, but I think, again, it can't be at the expense of the person who has experienced the most violence, who, like you said, might leave because they're like, well, fuck, like, no one's here for me, everyone's here for, like, both of us, and, like, right now I need people to understand that I'm the person who's been harmed the most. Like, where do we draw that kind of, like, distinction or that line and say, like, okay, cool, yeah, Nick, you sure, whatever, let's go to Lala right now, like, Lala's the one.
Yeah, I think that the community needs to be showing up for, okay, so in that example, for me and asking me, what do you need, how can we support you, and, like, continuing to show up, you know, the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day,
huge,
and whatever that might be. It also needs to look like holding you accountable. And if I want to have a conversation with you, I should have help, you know, from other people who maybe will be there to make sure you're not gaslighting me, to make sure that, you know, if you're doing more things that are harmful, that they, again, knowing, maybe being educated on all the red flags and what does harm look like, being able to stop you in your tracks and be like, hey, actually, that's not okay. Like, that's victim blaming. Like, no, you're not taking accountability for what you've done. Mm-hmm. I also think there need to be people who are able to kind of go off with you away from me and be like, okay, what's going on? Why are you doing this? Where is this coming from in you? Help you figure that out and heal that so that you don't keep doing it.
Yeah. As you're talking about this, I'm getting goosebumps because I'm thinking about, and this is, again, in the episode of this podcast with Brené Brown and Tarana Burke, like, bearing witness, like, really bearing witness to what's happening. Because, like, a lot of the times we'll be like, oh, we know that thing happened, but, like, we don't really know. That's, like, an interpersonal thing. Like, we just, like, that's them. They have a long-standing history of that. Really, you know, they're going to figure it out. There's this belief that, like, individualism, and it comes back to what you said at the beginning, we live in a really individualistic society. And it's, like, how crappy is it within our own communities that we rely back on the things that we know shouldn't sustain us, like individualism, and we just kind of, like, relegate people to figure out interpersonal conflict or harm that's happened between two people or three people or whatever, to they'll figure it out. No, we need to be standing and saying, like, I'm seeing this and naming it and, like, being open about it. And I think creating an environment where that's the norm, where there's not going to be turning away, or, I mean, like, privacy is important. I think, like, recognizing where people have boundaries and people might not want people to know, but then also coming back to, like, but why? Like, is it because you're scared that, like, the greater community is going to be, like, attacking you, the victim, or, like, upholding the behaviors or supporting the perpetrator? Like, no, we need to be able to stand and look at things in the face and say, like, this is the truth. The truth is that Nick hurt Lala. And this is what we're going to do. Like, the community being invested in, like, the individual relationships that exist between community members, not just, like, this queertopia that we have, but, like, who are the members that create queertopia? And what are the relationships that create what queertopia could be? Because that's like an ideal. It's not real, right? In order for us to get to that ideal, we have to continue to keep on like doing. It's not just like we're here, we show up, and that's that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then I think we all need to be doing this work on ourselves and with each other in community, because I think we need to be accountable to each other in all kinds of ways. So not only like if you hurt me, you know, being accountable for that, but also, you know, if there's other people in our community and somebody's not showing up for me, or like, right, you know, is enabling you in some way, yep, somebody else in the community being like, hey, what's up with it? Like, why are you not showing up for Lala?
Exactly. Yeah, way, yeah, right? Yeah. Yes, totally.
It's like all of the layers of it, because I think there's so many reasons. And I think we need to, I think it's so hard for people to hold space when it comes to this harm happening. And it's for so many reasons. Like, it's really hard to live in a world where there is this much violence, you know, at every level, you know, in the broader community, in our like small cutie BIPOC communities, everywhere, right? That's really hard. And a lot of people don't want to face that reality. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to see people you love in pain. Like, yeah, sometimes people, you know, they'll try to downplay what you're going through because they don't want to deal with the reality that somebody that they love has been this hurt.
Yeah. Or maybe it activates their own shit that they're like, oh God, this is too scary for me. I don't know how to
exactly
show you. Yeah.
Like, if I admit that what happened to you is violence, then I have to admit that what happened to me is violence.
Right.
Right. And that's too scary. Mm-hmm. Or I have to admit then that this thing that I did was violent.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's really scary too.
Yep.
So there's all kinds of reasons why we don't show up, and we have to do better, and we have to support each other to do better. It's like work we have to do on ourselves, but it's also, I think, work that we need each other's support with, and we need to be accountable to each other on all of these levels.
Yes. Yeah, we shouldn't be walking this alone, because ultimately what we're talking about is how do we be in relationship with one another? That requires other people. Like, it's not just, you know.
Exactly. And like in Kai Ching, Tom says, you know, she talks about building a community where we're really safe, and not safe as in totally free from risk, because such a thing is not possible in this life. I'm quoting her directly here. But she says, safe enough to pursue intimacy and adventure with the knowledge that there really was a community that had our backs.
Wow. That's so powerful. And yeah. I think that's like such an ideal. I think we think that that's what it is. And maybe we are in those, we're heading towards those spaces. But I think more often than not, we don't really have the foundations of what she's describing to have each other's backs in that like collective sense.
Yeah, there's all of this work for us to do on holding space. And I think there's all of this work that we need to do on unlearning in like deeper ways than we have. You know, I know I said at the beginning, like, it's, we're already doing the unlearning. And so, you know, where is it going wrong? But I think there's so much more to do. Like she said at one point in this book, that trans women's happiness lies in loving other trans women, which is such a beautiful thing to say. And I think, you know, loving ourselves and all of the parts of ourselves that we've been taught are wrong and not okay is so much of a part of healing. And I also think it's like all of us learning to truly love trans women of color and all of those among us who are most targeted by these systems. Mm-hmm. And again, like love in the bell hooks way, like,
yes,
real love, love as a verb, love with accountability and yeah, love with responsibility, and love that has nothing, I mean, not nothing to do with the emotion in our hearts, but the emotion in our hearts is like the tiniest part of it. It's like, how do we show that love?
Yeah.
Like, she says, when I think of all those trans women activists and leaders who died or went mad before their time, I wonder, what if their well-being had been celebrated as much as their work? What if the communities that promoted their art, built social programs off their ideas, profited off their labor, had been just as invested in preserving their lives and livelihoods? If that had been the case, would I have a trans mother or big sister now? Because she's talking about the ways that the older generations are wiped out. And what a incredible loss that is to our communities, and how much that is part of why our communities are floundering so much, is because so many of the people who had the experience and, you know, knowledge and wisdom that could lead us in better directions are being taken out in all kinds of ways.
Right. It's kind of like, you know, how people always say, like, give the person their flowers while they're still here. Like, how do we actually support the people that we pedestalize and that we love in our communities that are doing rad shit? How do we support them and their, like, well-being while they are with us? I was going to say still with us, but I'm like, we want them to be here for a long time. We're not trying, we're not, like, assuming that, like, they're going to go soon. We need to create the conditions for them to be here for a long time, which means, like you said, doing more than just the slow unlearning, or the unlearning at sometimes a surface level, but a deeper unlearning collectively together, and a deeper way of showing up for one another that, like, upholds and cultivates, like, wellness for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly. Because again, like, we've been talking all through this about the role of power and the ways that we grasp onto power and how that, you know, brings the harm from the outside world into our communities. And I think those of us in our communities who have the least access to power then end up becoming, you know, harmed again and again and leaving. And, you know, whether that's because they feel like they aren't safe anymore in our communities and they have to withdraw and isolate themselves, whether it's because they're literally killed, whether it's because, you know, their health collapses and they're no longer able to come in and be part of the public community, all of those things keep happening. And that is how we know that we're not doing it right. Like, that's how we know that our values are not being shown in the ways that we're actually building our communities.
Whoa. Damn, that's very true. That's a really good, that's, yeah, wow.
So I want to end with one more quote from this book. And again, I'm sure we'll talk about it more in future episodes. And I'd really recommend it to everybody because it's so important for this topic and for so much more. Like, everybody who cares about social justice, about the survival of our society and planet, like, I would so highly recommend this book. So this one last quote from Kai Ching Tom. We must invest deeply and fervently in the dignity of human life. We must not give in to the urge to do harm, even in justice's name. We must recognize, name, and transform the instinct to humiliate, harm, and coerce those we see as bad or as wrongdoers. No one is disposable. The community must accept its own responsibility for producing, condoning, and reproducing violence. We cannot spend years, decades in community spaces watching people act badly and hurt each other and making excuses for them, and then suddenly turn around and act shocked when an individual names that violence. We cannot pretend that we had no hand in covering up, minimizing, and even encouraging violence. We must love ourselves. We must encourage love. Love that is radical. Love that digs deep. Love that asks the hard questions. That is ready to listen to the whole story and keep loving anyway. Love for the survivors. Love for the perpetrators. Love for the survivors who have perpetrated and the perpetrators who have survived. Love for the community that has failed us all. We live in poison. The planet is dying. We can choose to consume each other, or we can choose love. Even in the midst of despair, there is always a choice. I hope we choose love.